listening to Truth to You with Jono, and I am speaking with Yoel Ben Shlomo. Why? Because why? Why? Yoel, what's going on? Why? Come on, what time of the year is it?
Something always happens sometime, doesn't it?
Well, that's true, but there's a particular thing that happens at this particular time of year.
Something that happens particular time of year, this year, every time. Let me think for a second. Oh, it's raining.
It's raining. It's actually, it's
that
just been.
That happens this time of year.
It's been snowing, actually, where you are.
Yeah, it's snowed. Yep, it's snowed. It snowed. So now everyone knows when we recorded this one. It snowed in Jerusalem Friday. Yeah. We had these big flakes.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean.
Oh, come on. It's got to do with the Book of Esther.
Does not ring a bell.
All right. Let me educate you, my friend.
The Book of what? Who?
All right, first of all, what I want to know is, what is the book called in the Tanakh?
It's called the Book of Estelle.
The Book of Estelle. But what was her actual name?
Okay, so her actual name was probably, according to the book, it says that her name was Hadassah. So there's an interesting thing regarding the names here. Estelle and Mordechai, mm-hmm. and according to certain pronunciations, Mordechai. Some put a different vowel point. These are actually names of deities, Babylonian deities, Marduk and Ishtar, which is considered to be something very, very strange by itself. Some people say that these were names given to them later on, or these were names that they used because they were officials. You know, if you look at the Book of Daniel, Daniel and his three friends mm-hmm. receive Babylonian names.
Sure.
You know, Abednego, Balthasar and Balthazar, you know, names like that. So yes. These might be names which were given to them later on. I mean, one of the things about the Persians was that they, when they took over Babylon, they also took over the culture.
Mm-hmm.
So the names carried on being more or less the same names. Though the Persians really, really practiced Zoroastrianism, they didn't forfeit everything that went on there in Babylon. So they actually have Esther as really Ishtar. It's just a bit of a change of the name. Also spelling sometimes the Samech and the Shin, Samech and Sin get replaced at one stage. Mordechai is very similar to Mordok, and everyone agrees that this is the meaning of the names.
Mm-hmm.
But the book itself is called the Book of Esther and not the Book of Mordechai, because really Esther is the, I would say, more of a leading character.
She's the star of the show.
Also, she's really the star of the show. We're talking about this young, according to Midrashim, she was old, but this young young woman who was Jewish, who becomes a queen.
Mm.
The story itself, the way it develops and builds up is quite interesting.
Oh, it's a fascinating story. It's a fascinating story that would leave any Shakespearean story for dead. This one wins out. This is so good.
I don't know. I mean, Macbeth, everyone dies there in the end. That's kind of cool, isn't it? I mean, it's very Greek that everyone dies in the end. You know? You know, all the Greek stories, everyone's like end up dead in the end. What is this? What's this whole thing about these Greek tragedies? You know,
true.
Life? You know, the Greeks were very big on the whole issue of celebration of life, but they keep on killing everyone in their shows. Like, what is this? You know, bump him off. I don't know why. Just get rid of him. It makes the show more interesting.
Anyhow, but isn't this so one here? Way, this one reason, this one ends so poetic. I mean, poetic justice is absolutely emphasized in the Book of Esther. It's brilliant. I love the way it comes together, and we're going to be getting there.
You're not letting me point something out.
Go on,
The reason we're being a bit more silly at the moment is because it's customary during the time of Purim to be a bit more joyful, a bit more funny. People do a lot of comic things. Mm. So we're being a bit silly. We're being a bit silly, but we're also going to be very, very serious. The other thing I want to point out.
I mean, I know this isn't TV or anything. It's not television, but I should just let the listeners know that I'm in a Batman uniform and you're in a Robin uniform.
No, I'm actually wearing my PJs. I'm still wearing my pajamas because I have a slight sinus infection, so I'm not planning on leaving home.
Fine. All right. Keep going.
Actually, I'm actually dressed in black. So if anyone's a Batman, it's me. I actually did dress up as Batman many, many years ago as a child. And I actually dressed up as the old Batman from the 1960s. So for some reason, my mother thought it would be funny for me to wear these gray tights. It didn't look very good. Everyone actually made fun of me. So thank you, Mom, for that.
Yeah. Bring that memory up. I think of you on Purim, I like to think that you dress up in a karate uniform with a chef's hat on, and you go out with your didgeridoo and do a bit of that. That's how I like to think of you on Purim.
No, I haven't dressed up for Purim in many, many years. The last costume I wore was a robe. I dressed up as a biblical Jew, and that was the last time I dressed up.
Okay. Ever.
Yeah, dressing up thing, we can talk about that as well. There's one thing I wanted to point out regarding the name Esther. In the rabbinical sources, they actually point out that the word Esther is very in the same sound as Hester. Instead of a ah, there's a sound, a hey. Mm-hmm. And they actually want to say that it's connected to the verse Va'anochi Hester Astir Panay Bayomahu. I think that's the verse, let me think. And that basically means that I will hide my face on that day, where basically, if you notice, you look at the book of Esther, the name of God is never mentioned there. We're going to put aside the issue of there's an apocrypha that adds this prayer of Mordechai that, you know, where he mentions the name of God. But in the book itself, the name of God is not even mentioned. There's also a message in the story. There's actually a very clear message in the story itself. But we'll get to that later on. Yes, Batman, to the Batmobile.
So I'm glad that you pointed that out, because it is very curious that this is, as far as I know, the only book in the Tanakh that does not mention the name of God, doesn't really mention God at all. But nevertheless, here it is. Hey, now, talking about names, can you, the first thing I need to know is, what is the name of the king? I can't pronounce his name. How do you pronounce the name of the king?
His name is Ahasuerus.
Okay, well, every time we come to that, you can say his name, all right?
So the Greeks called him Xerxes.
Xerxes, yeah, well, that's the one that I know, but Xerxes, but I opened up my new King James here, and it's got...
No, Xerxes, his name was Xerxes, that's the Greek name, Xerxes, that's his name, and his son was something else Xerxes, he had like a little, like, an extra bit to his name, but if we're already talking about the name of the king, first of all, the word king itself in the book appears close to 200 times, probably even more than 200 times, which is a very, very interesting thing. Mm-hmm. So some people say, oh, king really means God. King is really, they're really hinting to God here, because there's like, the whole notion there is this hand controlling everything from the background, as if, you know, you try to do one thing and something else comes out of it. Mm-hmm. You try to do something else, it's attached to something. It's how the story evolves. It's like Haman thinks of something, he wants to pull off a stunt, and then it just completely gets reversed. You know, that's basically the idea of the story, what's going on there. But yes, so if we're talking about Xerxes himself, there's actually a historical problem here, because it's no one's not 100% sure exactly where to place the story. Mm-hmm. And if you read through the book, whoever wrote the book had pretty good knowledge of the Persian world, of the way the system worked. I mean, for example, one of the examples I read about 2-3 years ago was that the king's government actually had 7 officials. There were 7 officials. It was the king, there was a prime minister, and then 6 other men who were considered to be his ministers.
Okay.
By the way, so Haman became the prime minister. He became the head of everything. But they were called, Ro'e Pnei HaMelech, the seers of the face of the king. So what they actually say is that the king, you weren't allowed to approach the king whenever you want, which we also see that in the story as well, where Esther wants to go speak with him. Mm-hmm. So she has to wait for him to give his golden staff, and she has to touch the head of him, and then she can speak with him.
Yep.
So, and apparently from what I read is that, yes, this is actually factual. Also, the issue of the city itself. The city is called Shushan. So, but Talmud asks a very, very interesting question. And, you know, when you look at it historically, they actually have a point there. But they say, wasn't the capital a different city? I can't remember the name of it at the moment, but was it a different city? And they say, oh, yeah, he decided to move his capital somewhere else. And it's actually true. Each king of Persia had his own city, his own capital. And Shushan was built at a certain stage. But one of the things about Shushan was that it was actually used only during the winter, because during the summer it was just too hot to be there. But what's also interesting is they describe it, at least from this article I read about Parasopolis, which is the Greek name of Shushan, is that, by the way, Parasopolis, basically Persian city. Polis is a Greek name for city. So, for example, Nabulus is Napolis, which means the new city, Neopolis, if we turn it more into Latin.
Yeah, sure.
And Parasopolis means the city of the Persians, or city of Persia. But what's very interesting is the way they describe the city. There's Shushan itself, and then Shushan HaBira. So there's actually the city itself, and inside the city there's another walled-off section, which is the Biran, or the word Bira by itself if we deal with the word birah, it's interesting word because it's a bit later Hebrew. So it kind of gives you a hint of when was the book written or certain words were replaced, maybe. We have that. For example, something very interesting that Nehemiah pointed out to me, as everyone knows, Nehemiah worked on the Dead Sea Scrolls. Mm. And he actually told me, you know, there's this verse in Isaiah. Now, I know this verse. I know how to explain this verse. But it was very interesting. Something else he pointed out about this verse. And it says, V'kochavim yahelu oram. And the word yahel is a word that appears, I think, only once in the Bible. So I know yahel means to shine, to glow, but that's because I've studied biblical Hebrew. I had encountered this verse many times, mm-hmm. and I learned what this word means. But he pointed out to me that in some of the Dead Sea Scrolls, instead of yahel, they replace it with yairu, which is just another word for to glow or to shine, from the word or, which means light. So yairu sounds like they will expose their light, they will shine. But what was very important here is the issue of exchanging words. So there is a chance that this word was replaced some other, maybe a Persian word, which was not understood, and then it became the word birah. Again, I'm not 100% sure. It's just a speculation. But what's very interesting, whoever wrote this also knew how the city was built. There was a city itself, and in the city itself was the center of control, which was basically the word birah means a citadel or a castle of sorts. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it means that there was inside the city a castle where all the offices and where the king's house was.
Right.
So this, whoever wrote this actually knew as well that how the city was built.
Sure.
So there's a lot of these little things. For example, who invented the mail? So Americans like to boast that Benjamin Franklin invented the mail, and he had what's called the Pony Express. He didn't invent it.
No.
The system itself was invented by the Persians. The Persians developed these roads.
And we see that on a number of occasions in the Book of Esther, the system of mail that they had, yeah.
Exactly. It repeats itself, and there's these special riders and everything, and how it worked, and they're sending messages. And basically, archaeologists say that they were able to send a message throughout the entire empire in like 7 days.
That's awesome.
Was that fast?
Yeah, because the empire is huge. I mean, it's massive. Yeah, but
the empire was very big. The empire was very, very big.
They had a system in place.
Yeah, so it seems that if we take this king, this Xerxes or this Ahasuerus, so he was in control of Persia when it was in its maximum, which meant it stretched all the way from basically Afghanistan, the city of the Medes, all the way to Libya, which was considered to be Kush. Though when I grew up, Kush was Ethiopia. That's how I was told, but I recently, not recently, a while back, I noticed that a lot of people actually say Kush is Libya, but it doesn't really matter. What we do see here is the empire was very, very big, and they also controlled Egypt, which is an issue by itself because it kind of throws the Egyptian chronicles off. If anyone wants to read about that, there's a very good book by Manuel Velikovsky, Worlds in Chaos. It's a very, very interesting book. I don't know if he's right about his theory there, but he does point out several interesting things regarding the Egyptian Empire and chronology and archaeology. If you remember when we spoke about the altar in Mount Eval, I pointed out something about archaeology. They're using Egyptian chronology. He tackles it. He has a very interesting point. I don't know if he's 100% right. I'm not an expert, but he has an interesting angle on that.
Okay.
So he controls 127 things called medinot. So in Hebrew, usually when we say the word medina, it means a state, a country.
Okay.
But what it probably means is that 127 capitals or 127 city states.
Like for example,
not even provinces. Probably what's called a city state, which basically like the Greeks had. Athens was a city, but it was also a state.
Mm-hmm.
Sparta was the same thing. All these cities, these had their own king and everything. That was quite normal. If you look, for example, the Book of Joshua, each major city had villages around it, but the city itself had its own king. So you can call it a province, or you can call it just a city by itself. So he was controlling 127 capitals of sorts.
Yeah, and so, I mean, he's an accomplished guy, right? I mean, that's a huge area. Well,
he inherited from his father. The story goes that, I think it was Koresh. I can't remember the names in English. Koresh was the first king of Persia. He was called Koresh the Mede. Koresh Hamadi, and he's mentioned, I think the Bible is Hamadi, which means the Mede. Then Dariavish received the empire from him. What happened with Dariavish, he went to Greece. He tried to attack Greece. He wanted to conquer Greece, and he knew that there's a chance that he won't come back, so he already made his son king. So his son was made king. He went to Greece to fight, lost the war. There's a very interesting YouTube movie about, it's called, what is it called? I can't remember what it's called. It's a program about Persia. It's you know, if you want to just read something, watch something light, you want to know about the history, I suggest that. You don't want to sit down and start reading, you know, Herodotus or something like that, which, you know, I love these little details. It's called Engineering and Empire. That's what the series is called, and you can find it on YouTube.
Okay.
It's very resourceful. I mean, again, you know, it's always better to, you know, sit down and actually read the books and everything, but you want to get something quickly into your head. It's a bit of information. You can also use these programs.
Nice.
So he went, and on the way back, he died. So Ahasuerus or Xerxes received the kingdom from his father when he was still alive. So they ask a question, so what is this massive feast of 180 days that he does on the third year of his reign? So some people explain this as being, first of all, this is completely normal for the Persians. You should know. This is considered to be completely normal. They did stuff like this. This is normal. Okay. 9 bazillion wives as well was completely normal.
9 bazillion wives and a big party and lots of wine.
Exactly. That's completely normal. Actually, I read something that claimed that actually some of the major state decisions were made when they were completely verschnicken, completely drunk.
Right.
You know? So what we see here is completely normal. You know, we're going to have a big party of 6 months. We're going to party. Okay.
Right. And it's all on the king. It's all on him. It's just put it on my tab. And it talks about also, gold and gold goblets and gold chairs and all sorts of beautiful array. And I mean, the place just looks fantastic. And that's the way that the book opens, right? This is the introduction to the story.
Yeah, showing the contrast of who the king was. Everyone's saying, first of all, remember something. By the way, the issue of drinking a lot of wine, it was actually a very Persian thing to boast about how much wine you could drink. That was also considered to be normal. By the way, they had this really interesting punishment there. When they wanted to punish someone, they gave him this huge goblet to drink from. And this was a punishment. You actually can die from this. And when they decided to punish someone during one of these festivals, they would make them drink this goblet of wine, which probably contains probably like a gallon of wine. And the person has to drink
really
this.
Really interesting. Because most people
died drinking it.
Because I did wonder about verse 8. It says, in accordance with the law, the drinking was not compulsory. Obviously, there was a type of drinking that was compulsory. Yep. It says here, this drinking is not compulsory, for the king had ordered all the officers of his household that they should do according to each man's pleasure. So you want some, you have some. If you don't want some, you don't have to have it.
Exactly. But in these feasts, people had to drink. You know, so there was like the people stand there, chug, chug, chug. You know, that was basically it. You know, old customs die hard. They don't vanish that quickly.
Right.
Really don't. But those times it was actually a punishment. So I actually saw a picture of one of these goblets, and these things were big.
Wow.
I mean, this was like a big, big thing. And now their wine was very different from the wine we have. It wasn't refined like we have. It's a very, very different type of wine. Mm-hmm. But that's besides the point. We can talk about wine in a moment.
Sure.
How to drink during Purim and not get drunk.
Yeah.
Well, very simple. Don't.
We'll get to that. It's the seventh day, right? Here we are on the seventh day of chug, chug, chug. And it says, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, and he commanded his maids, go and bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown in order to show her beauty to the people. But now, you know, because she was really fine, right? I mean, she was a beautiful woman, apparently. And all he wanted she was the queen. He just said, hey, bring her along because, you know, she's beautiful. Let us gaze upon the beauty of the queen. But lo and behold, she refuses to come at the king's command. And therefore the king was furious and his anger burned within him. And this is where it all really sort of nuts down into the story. He doesn't know what to do because what happened is, I mean, he's the king of this big, vast empire, right? As you've just explained, you know, 127 provinces or whatever they may be, from India to Ethiopia. And he's all of a sudden his own queen has denied him in public in front of everybody. And when they're meant to be all partying on and being happy, all of a sudden he is furious. And says to his nobles, what should be done about this? What should I do? And they get together and they say, look, let a royal decree, and this is verse 19, if it pleases the king, let a royal decree go out from him and let it be recorded in the laws of the Persians and the Medes so that it will not be altered, that Vashti shall come no more before the king. And what's his name?
Ahasuerus.
Thank you. And let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. Well, he likes the idea of that. And he says, So here we are, is the mailing system, right? Verse 22, yep. Then he sent letters to, to all the provinces.
Send out letters and yeah.
And it's not just sending the letters out into the provinces. It's each in their own language and all that sort of stuff as well. I mean, this is a highly sophisticated system, and that each man should be master in his own house. He thinks, what are
chauvinism? Chauvinism.
We can't let this happen. This is just not right. Let's put things right, and let's do it in a public way, seeing that she denied me in a public way, and that's what's going to be done. Now, it goes on in, where are we? Verse 2. The king's servants who attended him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king. And he went, oh, that's a good idea. And so off they went, and they looked for beautiful young virgins of Shushan to bring them back to Shushan, the citadel. This is what they did. In Shushan, the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai. Enter Mordecai. This is verse 5, where it first speaks about Mordecai, the son of Yair, the son of...
Yair,
the son of Shimi. All right, do you want to pronounce these names? The son of Kish, a Benjamite. How's that? Kish. Yoel.
Benyamini. So here's the first hint. He's a descendant of Saul, or he's a descendant from the house of Saul. Who was the first king to fight the Amalekites?
Right.
Quiz.
Hey, now this is interesting.
So that's hint number one already.
Hint number one already. And it goes on to say, Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with Yechoniah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. And now before we go on, Yechoniah. Now, this guy's got a couple of names, right? He's also known as...
He's known as Konyahu. Known as Shalom.
Konaya.
He's known as Meshulam.
Yehochanim.
So you have Yechoniahu, Konyahu, and there's also two other names that people attribute to him, which is Shalom and Meshulam.
Yeah. So at least now we know, you know, the kind of time that we're talking about. And I just want to jump to, what is it, Jeremiah 22. I'm just going to quote this. Jeremiah chapter 22 from verse 24. This is about English translation calls him Konaiah. As I live,
same person.
Same guy. As I live, says Jehovah, though Konaiah, the son of Jehochanim, king of Judah, were the signet on my right hand, yet I would pluck you off and give you into the hand of those who seek your life. And that's what happened. And into the hand of those whose face you fear, the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and the hand of the Chaldeans. So I will cast you out and your mother who bore you into another country where you were not born, and there you shall die. But to the land to which they desire to return, they shall not return. Is this man Konaiah a despised, broken idol, a vessel in which there is no pleasure? Why are they cast out, he and his descendants, and cast into the land which they do not know? O earth, 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 hear the word of Jehovah. Thus says Jehovah, write this man down as childless, a man who shall not prosper in his days, for none of his descendants shall prosper, sitting on the throne of David and ruling any more in Judah. That was the end of him.
Mm-hmm. So, ladies and gentlemen, we have the Book of Jeremiah narrated by Jonathan Dornau and Schultz.
Yep, thank you. And so he was a bad guy. He was a bad king, and so he got written off, right? No more of him. He was going to go into Babylon. This is what we read about here. And none of his descendants would sit on the throne of David. He's gone. But what we do have here is Mordecai. Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is, Esther, it says. So obviously both names are known. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. Her father and mother died. Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So there we go. It says in verse 10, Esther had not revealed her people or family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. And every day Mordecai paced in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what had happened to her, because, of course, she's been taken up into this idea that let's go throughout the land and bring all the beautiful young virgins into the citadel for the king, and someone's going to be the new queen. So even then, he keeps an eye on her, and he hangs out at the city gates, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it goes on to say that, you know, it's looking good for her. Esther, this is verse 15, I think. Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. Esther was taken to the king. What's his name?
Achashverosh.
Thank you. Into his royal place, the king loved Esther more than all other women. She's a winner.
Yeah, but there's a question here because she's not mentioned. Esther is not mentioned as the queen of Persia at the time. You know, it's there's a few historical issues that we do have to deal with regarding this thing. I don't think it's relevant to the show, but there are historical questions regarding certain things. For example, there's no record of any of the story even happening. But on the other hand, the fact is that we don't have all the records of the Persian kings. Apparently, most of them were lost, if not all of them. You know, but if you ever look on an academic level, the Book of Esther, everyone says, "Oh, it's basically an epic novel. It's really representing an idea and a story, not something which has actually happened in history." Just to point that out to people who want to
because there is research on the book. Concrete. In fact, there's no evidence really at all to suggest, or there's no archaeological evidence. There's nothing in permanent records that have lasted till today that would support this. But so she was the winner. The king loves Esther more than all other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti, and then the king made a great feast. Here's another feast, the Feast of Esther. There you go. For all these officials.
So it proves that he's Jewish, you know, because Jews always say we have this joke as like any reason for a party. You know, so let's eat, drink, and be merry.
And he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces and gave gifts according to the generosity of a king. There you go. It says, in those days, Mordecai, this is verse 21, he sat in the king's gates. And here's a key scene. You know, I would love to see a play of this. I'd love to see this acted out. I honestly
have. Well, there are several movies that play this out.
There's some movies, but I haven't seen. I mean, have you seen one that's? I mean, have you seen one that's in Hebrew? Perhaps that's any good.
No, there's this movie called One Night with the King. I think it's called.
Yeah, and that's all right.
It's based on the book. It's okay.
It's okay. It's not bad, I suppose. Anyway, he's in the gates, and two of the king's eunuchs. That'd be no fun. Doorkeepers became furious and sought to lay hands on the king. What's his name?
Achashverosh. You're planning on narrating the whole story, I get.
Well, no,
I'm basically going to be reading.
It's so exciting, you know. I'm trying to leave bits out, but it's also just, you know, I can't leave out any details.
Okay, so let's do it this way. Let's talk in general what happened instead of like reading specific verses.
But I mean,
no, because we're going to be sitting here for 2-3 hours.
Yeah, that's all right. It's riveting stuff. All right, okay, fine. Have it your way. So he's sitting at the gates. There's a couple of guys saying, "Hey, you know what? Not happy with the king. Going to write him off. He's got a silly name that no one can pronounce. I reckon that we should kill him." And so
it's a silly name that you cannot.
And so Mordecai hears about this, and he conveys it to Esther, right, who conveys it to the king. The king checks out the situation, finds Mordecai to be true, and so he puts these two guys to death, right?
Yeah, so we have several things that have happened up to now. We have him getting rid of the queen, getting the new queen, who happens to be Jewish. Mm-hmm. Mordecai becomes a kind of an official because he's related to the queen.
Mm-hmm.
He uncovers a plot, and his name is then written down in the story or the Book of Memory, the Chronicles of the King, as someone who saved the king.
Mm-hmm.
They get rid of these two guys, and the next thing that happens in the story is we have this man called Haman.
So,
Haman,
yeah,
Haman. The Amalekite, the Agagite, the descendant of the Amalekites. So, by the way, Agag was the king of Amalek.
Mm-hmm.
No, he was the king Saul battled.
Yeah, that should have been something, put to death, right?
Exactly, and they left the women, children alive. So they actually asked, you know, how is it Agag was killed? So it seems that maybe some of his children or some descendants of his actually survived what Saul did, and this is why God got so angry with Saul for what he did.
Yep. To obey is better than sacrifice. And so Haman.
So by the way, it's customary that when we read the Megillah, when we reach his name, people make noise.
Yes, to blood out his name.
Blood out his name the same way it says that to blood out his... the name of the memory of Amalek.
Mm. And so he's angry at Mordecai, right? Because every time he turns up, you know, people are meant to bow down to him and say such and such. But he won't bow down. Mordecai won't bow down, right?
Yep. So it actually was customary in the Persian world to bow down to the highest ranking officials, which is one issue by itself. Now, by the way, you should know, in the Bible, bowing down to someone important wasn't worshipping. So that wasn't the issue. But Haman himself represented something a bit more problematic than that. One of the explanations in the Midrash says that Haman was wearing a symbol of an idol on him all the time.
Ah, okay.
So by bowing to him, they were bowing down to the idol. Okay. That's an interpretation. I think that part of it was that he was just an anti-Semite, and Mordechai basically said, I'm not going to bow down to this anti-Semite. I'm not going to bow down to this Jew hater.
Actually, I like that better.
In his face, he's going to do.
I like that better because in verse 4 of chapter 3, it says Mordechai had told them that he was a Jew. That's all we have to go on, the reason why he won't bow down. So somehow it's infringement to the Torah, or it's there's an issue at hand by which he just will not lower himself before this guy. Either way, it's kind of cool, and I like Mordechai. So Mordechai sought to destroy him.
He established the original JDL.
What's that? You know,
JDL was the original movement that Rabbi Meir Kahana created in the 1970s in the U.S. It was called the Jewish Defense League. They actually became outlawed. It's actually considered to be, the movement itself is considered to be a terrorist group where I've read a lot of the history of it, and I don't know 100% sure if it really qualifies as terrorism, but they did terrorize a few people. So maybe they're right about that.
Well, you know, it's interesting because it talks about, in the end of this book, it talks about the fear of the Jews. There were people who were terrorized of the Jews in the end of this book.
Yeah, so that will be something that will actually probably tell you that this story is a bit of more of an epic novel than anything else. I don't know of any period where people actually feared Jews.
Well, you know. All right. But in any case, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole. So it wasn't just Mordechai. It was all of them. He just wanted to wipe out the people of Mordechai, is how they are described in verse 6.
Classic anti-Semitism. You have one Jew causes trouble. Okay, no problem. Let's kill all of them. You know, actually, some of the commentators I've seen, more of the academic ones, are saying this is a book that basically shows classic anti-Semitism.
Sure. Yeah, and isn't it? Now, by the way, and this is one for you. This is verse 7. There is a word used in verse 7. Pur. What is it? Pur.
Okay, so the word pur. 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 Okay, so word pur, first of all, is not Hebrew word. It's probably some kind of, I don't know if it's even Persian. It might be something, you know, Akkadian or something like that. I mean, I can actually pull out. Let me look at the dictionary for a second. Mm-hmm. It's obviously not, it's not a Hebrew word, but the word itself means a lot. Basically, they were used to cast a lot in front of a person who was who worked in deviation, and basically he would be able to give the results. So one of the things I saw was that they had this cube, and the cube had different writings over it. Mm-hmm. And they used to cast this several times, and then based on the result, so it's probably from Akkadian, and the word is puru. It basically means a lot, a casting a lot or something. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It was done by a person who was an expert in explaining what these signs mean.
Okay.
And he throws it for him, and he gives him an answer. He tells him, okay, sometime during the month of Nisan, which is the first month,
mm-hmm.
and he tells him, okay, this is when you're going to do whatever you want to do. It's a good day.
Okay.
So what's very interesting, he I think it says here, let me find, okay, so it says the 13th day, so some expressions I saw say the 13th day was considered to be a good luck day. So unlike what you have in the Western world where the 13th day of the month is considered to be a bad day, and if it's Friday the 13th, it's even worse. So here the 13th was actually a good number. It was a lucky number.
And they were happy with that.
And he was very happy, very pleased with this.
Hmm.
And
I was just going to say, in verse 13, it says that's the day. And again, the letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy and kill and to annihilate the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their possessions, it says. A copy of the document was issued as law in every province, being published for all the people that they should be ready for that day. And the couriers went out and hastened by the king's command, and the decree was proclaimed in Shushan.
Yeah, so let me correct a few things here. So he went, so first of all, by the way, you should notice that the story begins in the 13th, in the third year, but this part of the story happens in the 12th year of the king Ahasuerus.
Mm-hmm.
So this is 9 years later. So it says here, verse 7, it says on the first day, on the first month, which is the month of Nisan, the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, he did the pur, he peeled pur. So the people sound is a bit of a game, which is a lot for Haman from day to day and from month to month. The 12th month is the month of Adar. And he sends the messengers out on the 13th. So that was considered as if a lucky day for him.
Mm-hmm.
But really it was supposed to happen during the month of Adar. And this is why Purim is on Adar, on the 12th month. But they do it on Nisan, and then the next year it's actually going to happen.
Right, yeah.
So this is an interesting game. He throws a lot. But the thing is that these lots always have double-sided. So it's going to say, it's a good day to do something. This is how vague these things were. Right. So he tells him, oh, this will be a great day to do something. The 13th day of Adar. And he goes like, okay, great, I'll do it that day. But it kind of like flips on him in the end. This is the game that goes on in the book, that he wants to do something and he always goes on the flip side.
It always works against him.
So here's an interesting idea. The Iranians are trying to develop, the Persians are trying to develop atomic weapons. The moment they try to fire it, blows up in their face.
Yeah. I don't know. Well, it's not working for them at the moment, is it? I mean, it's all kind of turmoil there at the moment and things are heating up. So we'll wait and see what happens. And again, there's another reason why I guess I'm so into this book at the moment. And it says, so the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Shushan was perplexed. And when Mordecai learned all that had happened, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city and he cried aloud, a bitter cry. And it goes on to say that when there was great mourning among the Jews with fasting, weeping and wailing, and many in sackcloth and ashes. And this came to Esther's attention, right?
Mm-hmm. And she, her servant runs up to her and says to her, Mordechai is sitting at the gate of the capital, the gate of the palace, dressed in sackcloth and everything's ripped. Mm. So she sends clothing because she doesn't understand what's going on. So he sends back to her the scroll saying, this is what's happening.
Mm.
So she lets him in. He communicates with her through a servant. And there's an interesting thing he says to her. He says, who knows if not for this you become the queen?
Yes.
And if you decide that you'll be able to save yourself by hiding in the king's palace, you and your father's house will be destroyed and salvation will come to the Jews from a different source.
Uh-huh. That's right. Because she says, look, he hasn't called for me for 30 days even. If I go before him without his permission, the law is that, anyone who does that, they just die unless he holds out to them the golden scepter. She goes, now I can try that, but, I might die, And this is what Mordecai says. He says, do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this. That's pretty cool. So they're
pointing out this understanding that things happen for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
They're saying it very, very clearly. Who knows? Maybe this is why it's happened.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting mindset. But you see here the issue of God governing the world, but hiding behind nature, hiding behind natural things. Miracles happening left, right, and center is actually considered to be something unusual.
Sure.
So this is why
the world was circumstances, right?
Exactly, and that's probably what happened most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
The sky, the heavens didn't open every time, and God's hand stretched out and did something.
Sure.
God also works from behind. So you can say that this book really also tries to say, tell an idea that, it doesn't really matter. God is always intervening somehow, but you won't always notice it.
Sure. And so she says, okay, well, fine, I'll give it a go. You fast for me, 3 days, and I'll go to the king, even though it's against the law. And if I perish, I perish, she says. So so she's prepared to do it. So she puts
on... By the way, it's three days, day and night.
Day and night, yeah.
They fasted for 3 days. So by the way, a human being that doesn't drink can last without liquids, can survive 3 days by stretching it, 3 days without drinking. But after 3 days, a person dehydrates and can die.
Mm.
So 3 days is very specific.
So don't try this at home, kids. So
don't try this at home, kids. Exactly.
It was when the king saw the queen. So she comes, right? She dresses up in the royal gown and she does all of that. She comes and stands in the courtyard. And when the king saw the queen Esther standing in the court, she found favor in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. And Esther went near and touched the top of the scepter just as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So here's another interesting thing. She goes and she's not called, and she anyhow finds favor.
Mm.
She's always finding favor. So you can actually say that she's representing, if you take a metaphor out of it, she's representing the people of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And she always finds favor.
Mm, brilliant.
No matter what.
I like that. And so he says, what? Now, I like the way that he says this. He says, look, you ask of me any request and I shall give it to you up to half the kingdom. And what she does is she invites him and Haman to a dinner, I suppose.
So Haman is becoming even more important.
Yeah.
You know, he's going up and up and up and up.
Yeah,
and
that's now he's
been invited to this personal audience with the queen and the
king. She's
puffed
him up.
Wow, he's...
She's puffed him up into a false sense of security, right?
He's getting nuclear weapons.
He's getting nuclear weapons. And it says in verse 9, so Haman went out. I keep pronouncing his name with a chet. You know why I do that? Because I like going...
Yeah, because you're trying to... So the issue here is that when you're trying to compensate for a sound, you know, you're trying to learn a sound that you're not used to from your own language.
I
have this with my students all the time. You learn to make this sound like, wow, I've never... This doesn't appear in my language. You start dumping it in different places where it's not supposed to be. It reminds me of kids... when I was a teenager and when I was a kid in Israel, you know, Ashkenazi Jews don't have the guttural A, the Ayn that we have in Hebrew. Yeah. So when they discover this Ayn, they start using it in different places where there's no need for it. You know, so it's the same thing.
And I still can't make that noise, that blah, 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 blah. Blah. Can't do it. Anyway, so Haman went out that day joyful and glad, but when Haman saw Mordecai at the king's gate and that he did not stand or tremble before him, he was filled with indignation against Mordecai. There we go. And then so he goes and has a whinge to his wife. He goes home to his wife and he goes,
Yeah, he whines a lot. He's a whiner, this one.
He is.
So she tells him, what are you whining about? So get rid of the guy, kill him.
And how? Now, this is what I want to ask you. What's the historical? And I have in my English Bible here, I've got a gallows was made, a gallows. And to me, that sounds like they're just going to hang him from the neck. Is that what that was?
It might have been that. It might have been some form of crucifixion.
Interesting. I kind of think that it wasn't by the rope. I remember reading something about actually, you know, putting someone through the spike, sort of Count Dracula style.
Yeah, no, but Vlad the Impaler. Vlad the Impaler. No, I don't think, because it's he makes a 50 cubit thing, so you know you can't spike someone on that. And then I don't think it works. So mm-hmm. This is part. It says hang him on it. So to hang someone at those times might have been some kind of crucifixion.
Yeah,
it's interesting. He wants to put it high up in the air so everyone can see it.
Yeah.
And by the way, you should know that in Iran, when they execute people by hanging, they hang them from cranes so everyone can see.
Oh man, boy. So so she says that she.
Sorry about that. I'm sorry about that. But there's things that go on today in that country.
It's gruesome. It's gruesome.
Very, very, very similar to what we see here as well.
Mm-hmm.
So he whines. She tells him, go. I'm going to start cutting this very, very quickly. She goes, tells him, go execute him. He runs to the king. He goes to the king. And for some reason that night, the king can't sleep. They mm-hmm. bring the book. They read to him that Mordechai saved his life. He says, anything happened, we pay him.
Oh, this is brilliant.
They say no. He goes in and he says for some reason, who's in the yard? Who's in the royal court?
Who's out there? I need a bright idea. Give me a bright idea. Who's out there?
This king can't think for himself. It's kind of insane. And it's interesting. He's been manipulated. His mind, he's a king of an empire. You obviously could think, but he's been manipulated here over and over again. Mm. He can't think for himself because we don't want you to think now. We want you to do something according to our will.
Mm-hmm.
So, God says, basically, I want you to do what I want you to do. Therefore, I'm going to shut down your brain. You're going to do what I do. You're going to be my puppet.
Fair enough. And so he is.
So he calls in Haman. And he says to him, well, what kind of lavish thing I can do for a person the king wants to exalt
and
delight
to honor.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, you're using the word delight, and the word there is chefetz, which means more of a will. It translates as delight, where it doesn't work. That's not what it means.
So desire is probably better. As someone desires to honor.
Yeah, I think the word chefetz is from the word lachfotz, which means to desire, to have a will. And he says to him, okay, so you can start seeing who Haman is. He says to him, "Oh, you take a crown and clothing of the crown of the king, clothing of the king, and the horse of the king." And you have some important person from the king's government walking out and yelling out, "This is what the king does for people that he desires to exalt." And, you know, by the way, when the king responds to him, he emits the crown. He takes the crown out of the list. And it says, tells him, take the clothing and the horse. But what does he say to him? And this is where Haman kind of realizes, okay, that's it, I'm done for. His wife puts that out.
It's in verse 6, because Haman thought in his heart, whom would the king delight to honor more than me? And so he's thinking, sure, you do this and this and this, and that'll make me happy. And so the king says to Haman in verse 10, hurry, take the robe and the horse, as you have suggested, and do so for Mordechai the Jew, who sits within the king's gates, and leave nothing undone that you have spoken. Oh boy, didn't that?
Think about it. Think where his probably jaw dropped to the floor, and his heart was somewhere around his ankles when this happened. Okay, he goes like, "Whoa!"
Most definitely.
That probably was his response inside. He's like, "You're kidding."
And so, but he had to do it.
Chop, chop.
He had to do it. There was no way out of it. He had to do it. But afterwards,
and if he disagrees, he'd get executed.
He'd get executed. But afterwards, he went back to the king's gate, but Haman hurried home to his house mourning with his head covered, and went back to his wife and went,
By the way, Haman Tushans. What is a Tushan? A tushin is a Yiddish word which means ear. So Haman tushin are these rectangular cookies filled with different, you know, sweet whatever it would be, jam, or my favorite is with poppy seeds.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the classic ones I grew up with as a child, and that was the one everyone made. But the whole reason they're rectangular is because they say that his ears, like a dog, his ears folded into a rectangle, like his ears dropped. Oh.
Right.
Making it look like a rectangular. So we make ears to represent we make Haman Tushan, what we're calling them in Hebrew, Ozne Haman, the ears of Haman, cool, to represent the disgrace he was in.
Excellent.
So the sages had this way of adding colorful descriptions. So they say he was walking with this. Now, he was talking about how important it was to his daughter was convinced that was Mordechai. So she threw the bucket of the garbage out of the window on his head.
Oh.
And, that was even more disgraceful.
Even better. I'm not opposed to that. And now his wife says something kind of interesting. It's as if she sees the white writing on the wall. Is this how I'm to understand this in verse 13? She says,
if he's conceited of the Jews, that's it. You're done for it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, it wasn't a secret, though. I mean, for years, Haman has known that Mordechai is a Jew. And now she's saying to him, oh, if he's a Jew, oh, well, no, you're done for. I mean,
so,
you know.
So, by the way, notice something interesting. The first time when he's like boasting about how important he is, so it's Zeresh, which is the name of his wife, Zeresh, and his close people, his relatives, the people who are close to him. Here it suddenly becomes Zeresh and his advisors.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's a completely different scenario now. Oh, you're now done for it. We're gonna kick you out. You know, we're just your advisors. We're not your friends anymore.
Yeah, that's interesting. And so in any case, he doesn't have that much time to sort of whine about it. He's got to rush off to the banquet. This is the second banquet, right?
Second banquet. She's leading them slowly into it. She's teasing the king.
Mm-hmm.
She invites it once. There's a tactic here. She invites it once. And she says, "I'll just come back tomorrow." And he's like, "What does she want? I don't get this. It's driving me mad. What does she want from me?"
So it's heightened his curiosity. So they've got to be there.
She's heightening his curiosity. And he's like, this is his favorite queen or his favorite woman. And he's like, okay, what does she want? And he's like, mm-hmm, going, whatever she wants, I'll give it to her. I don't care. I just want to know what she wants.
Mm.
He's being played with. He's a puppet.
Mm.
And so she invites him. And then she says, when they sit down there, and Haman's like, okay, I had this embarrassing incident out there now, but I'm back in my important place.
Mm-hmm.
And then she pulls out the ace. She pulls out the ace, puts it on the table, and says, well, my nation wants to be exterminated. You know, if you want to read those specific verses, the way she describes it.
Yeah, sure. I read it. The Queen Esther answered and said to the king, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases my king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request, for we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Had we been sold as, you know, into slavery or whatever, I would not have held. I would just hold my tongue. Although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss. And so the king, what's his name?
Ahasuerus.
Thank you. Answered and said to Queen Esther, "Who is he, and where is he? Who would dare presume?" presume, in his heart to do such a thing. And Esther said, what did she say?
That guy over here, that idiot here with the triangle ears. What's your name? I forget your name. Haman? Was it Haman? Yeah, that guy.
That guy there. And he was terrified. Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. And the king arose in his wrath and went from the banquet. He's obviously gone to sort of think about what am I going to do? Because this guy's like my main guy, you know. And now what am I going to do? So he's gone to have a think about it.
Now what happens? He starts begging for his life. So he goes, they used to lay on these beds. So he's leaning on the bed begging. What does that look like?
It looks like
the king comes back and sees this and he's like, you're trying to seduce my queen?
Yeah,
man, you're that thick? Are you that stupid?
And that was it. And as the words left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Hey, nice one. They took
it says v'pnei Haman chafu. So the word is chafa, the root is chafa, which is usually from the word chofe or lachfof, which means to cover. But what it means basically, his face dropped. It was like as if his face covered by leaning his face down. So it's like the concept of avel v'chafui rosh. So avel v'chafui rosh is a person in mourning. So the custom in the ancient world was actually at least there's rabbinic, there's Jewish custom. No one really practices this these days. But I actually met one very important rabbi who did practice this when his father died. And what they do is they cover their faces.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be either with your hands. He wears talit, so he covered his face with his prayer shawl, and that's the idea of avel v'chafui rosh. So when he says upnei Haman chafu, it means that he was a sign of basically, okay, I'm done for it, and he was basically sad.
And he just resigned to his fate, basically. And that's when he
said, okay, I'm done for it.
I'm done for it. It's all over. And one of the eunuchs pointed out to the king, hey, check it out. Check out the gallows over there. Haman made for Mordechai. He was going to put him on it. The king said, hang Haman on it. And so they hung Haman on the gallows.
Hang him now.
Do it now that he had prepared for Mordechai, and the king's wrath subsided. So now that takes care of one major problem. But the other major problem is, of course, that the command has already gone out into all the providences that on such and such a day, they're going to write off the Jews, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm. So she runs over the king and says to him, well, we have to get rid of this. He says, listen, I already made a decree. I can't take it back.
Mm-hmm.
So what they do the opposite. They say, okay, Jews can defend themselves. So they couldn't cancel the original decree, but they say, okay, let's hope that the Jews are able to defend themselves. And boy, did they do.
Yeah, and didn't they?
1948, 2,000 years ago. 2,500 years ago. 1948, all over again. There was this will to destroy the Jews, and the Jews protected themselves. And, you know, what's very, very interesting here as well is that Haman says in the letter, you know, to kill all the Jews and take
and
their
plunder
goods,
their possessions,
and plunder their possessions.
Mm-hmm. At verse 9, I'm sorry, chapter 9, verse 3. Let me go to chapter 9, verse 2 almost. On the day that the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, the opposite occurred in that the Jews themselves overpowered those who hated them. And it goes on to say in verse 3, and all the officials of the provinces, all the governors and all those guys and all those that were doing the king's work helped the Jews. They helped the Jews because why? Because of the fear of Mordechai. The fear of Mordechai fell upon them. For Mordechai was great in the king's palace. His fame spread throughout the provinces. For this man, Mordechai, became increasingly prominent.
Yeah, so they had to reverse everything. And one of the ways of doing it was making Mordechai, instead of Haman, he gets the ring and he stamps it and says, okay, now go out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so now there's two problems are over. The last thing that they take care of, it seems, is in verse 10. The 10 sons of Haman, they also killed them. The enemy, the 10 sons of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, they killed. And so they took care of him as well. And Mordechai is now over Haman's house. He's got all of that. He's got his position. He's the new man. And here we are at verse 18, the Feast of Purim.
So before that, we have several things that happen. The attack starts on the 14th. The Jews defend themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They defeat them. But in the city of Shushan, well, so it's the 13th, and then they rest on the 14th.
Mm-hmm.
In the city of Shushan, for some reason, they decide, okay, we have to do another day. So they have another battle on the 14th, and then they have a battle for 2 days, and then on the 15th, they rest. And this is where there's actually 2 days of Purim. Now, it's a very interesting thing here, exactly how when do you celebrate Purim. So the practice in the Jewish world is to celebrate in walled cities from the time of Joshua, walled cities in general, Mm-hmm. But mostly from the time of Joshua, they practiced only on the 15th. So it's only one day. And in other cities, what the unwalled cities are, Areha Perazot, the cities that were sit what's called Perazot, which means, with no walls, just open, they celebrate on the 14th. So for example, here in Jerusalem, we celebrate on the 15th.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of the country, really, there's a very, very few places that actually celebrate on the 15th. And most of the country celebrates on the 14th.
Okay.
Now, what does it mean during Purim? So now we're going to go more. We told the story. We've been on this for about an hour already. So there's a few details regarding how is Purim celebrated in the Jewish world. So part number one has to do with the issue of reading the Megillah itself. So people, the communities go into the synagogue in the evening because we start counting from sunset, so people mm-hmm. go, they have the evening prayer,
mm-hmm.
and they read the Megillah. Now, when we say read it, and with the word Megillah, Megillah means a scroll. So what you have there is something which is written exactly like a Torah scroll, it's just the Book of Esther. And they read it out, and you have this guy who reads it out with a tune and everything. It's customary in most places to make noise every time they read the name of Haman. It's read, and then people go home, and you know, kids dress up. The whole issue of dressing up comes from Europe. Because the festivities in Europe, people, what was festivity in Europe? Carnivals. What do you do in a carnival? You dress up. You put a disguise on.
Sure.
So that's how that developed. It's not as if you have to do so. And it also has nothing to do with pagan practices. It's just, this is how people in Europe of the Renaissance had fun.
Sure.
You dress up, you go out to the street, and it's fun. You know, you're someone else or whatever it would be. Hmm. So I don't think there's anything that has to do with pagan practices. I think it's just something kind of stupid of imitating these carnivals. That's why I stopped doing these things,
mm-hmm.
Dressing up and everything. But as a kid, my parents always dressed me up because it's Purim. This is what you do.
Mm, sure.
So you go back home. People usually have a slightly festive meal because of festivity. The it says Yom Mishteh Simcha, a day of Mishteh is basically a feast and mm-hmm. happiness and joyfulness. So what's done is then people wake up in the morning, go to bed, regular, there's nothing special. You're allowed to do work, technically allowed to do work. Most people don't work on these days.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go back, it's read again now. The reading itself, everyone has to hear the reading. So women, children, everyone goes to synagogue. And women that have, for example, families that have children, and it's kind of difficult. So what they do is, small children are exempt from it. You don't have to take your small children.
Mm-hmm.
But women that have children or families that they have to keep an eye open on children, they make a decision, or the husband and wife make a decision, who is going to go first, and then they have several readings throughout the day or throughout the evening as well.
Yep.
For families that one of the parents had to watch over the children. Usually it's reading for women. Because usually in the Orthodox world, women watch over the children, and then the husband replaces the wife. He watches over the children, and then she goes and listens to the reading. The next day, people start preparing these gifts. So it says, Mishloach manot ish lere'ehu matanot le'evyonim, sending portions to friends and gifts to the poor, gifts to the needy.
So that's what it says in verse 19, right? It says, therefore the Jews of the villages who dwelt in the unwalled town celebrated the 14th day of the month of Adar with gladness and feasting, as a holiday, and for sending presents to one another. Okay.
Yes. So usually presents mean that people send food.
Mm-hmm.
So people prepare. In most cases, most people like make junk food, and they send, they buy sweets and stuff like that and send over. I usually send actual foods. So I have a bunch of people I know that I want to feed them because also, again, I'm a professional cook, so it's always interesting to get food from a professional cook.
Nice.
So I make food, and I say, I bake breads and I make pastes. And if I want to start feeding them, really feeding them, I start making chicken or beef or whatever it would be. And I send it over.
Yeah.
And there were years where I actually went to families and gave them their entire, there was two, three families I knew were gathering together to sit for a meal. So I brought it over and gave them actual food.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually gave them their meal.
Nice.
And that was my gift to them.
Yeah.
And then people also, it's a day where people give a lot of charity.
Mm-hmm.
So you have these officials that go around in our neighborhood. There's an organized thing. So, everyone that knocks on your door give you money. There's someone who takes care of the neighborhood needy, and they collect money and then they give it out secretly so people don't know who's who and not to embarrass anyone.
Sure.
You can also, but a lot of people walk around with money, coins in their pockets, and every person that walks up to them and says they're collecting money, they give the money as well. So always,
nice.
I usually, when this happens, I leave my wallet at home. I have a certain amount of money in my pocket, and every time I bump into someone like this, I give them whatever I have in a bit of what I have in my pocket.
So it's a time of where everyone just sort of shares a bit of generosity around, and particularly takes into consideration those who are less fortunate, And so that's the whole spirit of the of a couple of days around Purim. Now in verse 26 it says, so they called these days Purim after the name Pur. Now you've already explained to us what the Pur is, and Purim being the plural. Why did they name it after that? Because that was the day that
there's two days. So it's Purim. We're not going to call it just the day of the Pur. There's 2 days. We're going to call it Purim. And it says, Yemei HaPurim HaEle, these days of Purim.
Fair enough. There
so the pluralization has to do with the issue of the 2 days. I'm actually proud of you remembering some of your Hebrew. and then people sit down for a meal. What happens next is people sit down for a meal. Mm-hmm. Usually it's a festive meal. So it's, you know, families make sure it's a bit lavish or very lavish. It really depends on the families. You know, if you can buy, I don't know, filet mignon and make, I don't know, medallions or Wellington, whatever it would be, you know, whatever you want to make. I mean, if you can buy really, really expensive. I know families just go to a restaurant. You know, some families, there's a couple of families I know that during Purim just go to a restaurant or they buy food and take it home. It really depends. It really depends who you are and what you want to do. I mean, I personally usually, you know, either have guests over and everything. We share food. Everyone brings whatever they can make and we share it together. And I had cases where we made food. There was so much food that we ate good for like 2-3 days.
Nice.
You know, we could keep on eating for 2-3 days.
So it is a real day of feasting, right? It's a real day of feasting.
Yeah, there's only one custom I'm very, very opposed to, and I'm not the only one who opposes to this. Mm-hmm. And there's a statement in the Talmud that says, Hayav inish levesume befuraya ad lo yada bin baruch Mordechai laru Haman. It says a person has to besume. Well, this is the issue. There's besume and there's revaya. These are two Aramaic words that have very distinct meanings. So besume means to, you know, be a bit tipsy, you know, drink to a level more than usual drinking. Right. And on the other hand, to get drunk in Aramaic means revaya, to really fill yourself with alcohol. So it says that, and I actually sat down with a rabbi a couple of years ago, and he actually explained the difference in between these things. It was fascinating, because this was towards Purim, and he basically said, you're not supposed to get drunk. You're supposed to drink alcohol to a level where it makes you joyful. So there's this famous story. There's this famous midrash. I don't know if it's famous. I mean, if you've ever seen the movie Masada, they pointed out that it's a great... By the way, if you want to watch a really interesting movie, there's a movie called Masada. It's a miniseries. It's worthwhile watching. It was very interesting I watched it.
Is that the one
years
with Peter O'Toole?
That's the one with Peter O'Toole. Exactly.
Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah, it's great. He was great in it. Yeah.
It's a very, very, very good program. Yeah. Very, very good miniseries.
For sure.
And it's interesting, and it shows you some of the diversity of the Second Temple period and what things that happened at the time. It's a very, very interesting program. Mm. So anyhow, one of the things that happens is people get drunk, and sometimes they get very drunk. Mm-hmm. So there's a story, you know, Elazar ben Yair, the head of the rebellion on Masada, looks at Silver and says to him, which is Peter O'Toole, he says to him, our rabbis held this interesting idea that when Noah planted the first vineyard after the flood, the devil came over. And by the way, you know, the devil, Judaism doesn't really believe in the devil. We can talk about that some other time.
Sure.
But when the devil came, they're talking about basically the idea of the adversary. Mm-hmm. But the devil came and slaughtered 4 animals. In the beginning, he slaughtered a sheep. Then he slaughtered a lion. Then he slaughtered a monkey. And then he slaughtered a pig. Mm. It says, when a man walks up to wine, he's like a sheep. He starts drinking. Nothing happens. Then he becomes a lion, and he thinks he can take over everyone. And then he becomes, if he drinks more, becomes a monkey. And he's just running around. And in the end, he becomes a pig, and he's swimming in his own filth.
Yeah.
And he says, and this is the issue with alcohol. People don't, you know, in a society, you shouldn't say something. In the Orthodox society, people don't get drunk. Mm-hmm. It's actually our society, the Orthodox society. I'm talking about Orthodox, I mean, observant people. You can have people call themselves Orthodox, but you know, they're Orthodox, but not exactly. They'll go out drinking once a week, and they might get a bit, you know, slightly.
So what are you saying? We can't go to the pub and sing L'chaim?
So that's the difference. There's a difference in the way you drink. What happens here, I mean, for example, there have been years where during Purim was difficult to walk in the street because people were just, you know, anywhere in Israel.
Sure.
People just drink too much. They go overboard. Mm-hmm. And it shows kind of a lack of control. So I personally, you know, I drink a bit. I don't drink that much alcohol. I actually go very strongly according to what appears in Proverbs, where he talks about not drinking too much wine or even getting close to alcohol. And I personally practice, I think that alcohol is a good thing, but it has to have its times. One of the jokes, it has its limits, it has its times. Also, people in the ancient world used to drink wine like a beverage, but their wine was very, very different. Part of it was drinking alcohol with your water, because water was sometimes very poisonous. So the drinking alcohol together with your water killed any bacteria, anything dangerous you might have had.
Okay.
What if the situation is where they had water and they built these cisterns to collect water, and sometimes during the summer the water starts running out, and the end of the water you have is not very healthy to drink.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the water itself wasn't clean in general. It doesn't go through filters like we have today. So people drank alcohol with the water to survive.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very opposed to this. Maimonides, for example, the Rambam, he was very opposed to the whole issue of getting completely drunk. So this is the one thing. This is the one thing that makes pulling for me kind of sad. This type of behavior, I think it's wrong. It's not supposed to be done.
So a bottle of wine shared with friends is probably not a bad thing.
Yeah, it's not a bad thing. It's the issue. You know, it's like you would drink wine during a wedding or a celebration of some
sort. Sure.
Drink wine. You sometimes drink more than what you usually drink. You have weddings, for example, where people that drink quite a bit, but they're still happy. It's still joyful. It's still fun.
Right.
You're not supposed to wake up the next day with a hangover.
Right. Fair enough.
I don't think that's the purpose.
You don't want to wake up the next day regretting the night before. That's fair enough. It doesn't really sort of reflect the spirit of Purim. And so there it is. There, it's coming up, boys and girls. Enjoy it. Remember what it's about. Don't get hammered, as we say here in Australia.
And well, I think hammered is also an American expression.
Is it? All right. Fair enough.
I've heard this expression from Americans.
And thank you, Yoel Ben Shlomo. Oh, hang on. Before we disappear, I'm going to read the very last verse. This is it's only three verses in the last chapter of Esther, chapter 10. It says, "For Mordechai, the Jew, was second to King," what's his name?
Achashverosh.
Thank you. And was great.
Now you have to practice it.
No, I'm not going to say it. I don't know.
Achashverosh.
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 Maybe if I had rehearsed this before the program. Achashverosh.
Ah, now you know the secret.
And was great among the Jews, and well received by the multitude of his brethren, seeking the good of his people and speaking peace to all his countrymen, which is just a great way to end it, I think. And thank you, Yoel Ben Shlomo, and my Hebrew teacher, HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. If you would like to get quality Hebrew lessons from this very knowledgeable man, we thank you for your time once again. And just a reminder to the listeners, Hebrew in Israel you can find on Facebook as well. So thank you, Yoel. Thank you for coming on and sharing with us Purim.
Yeah, and Purim, by the way.
Purim.
Purim. Purim. Purim. Purim. Repeat after me.
Purim. Purim. And the king's name again?
By the way.
The king's name, one more time.
Achash.
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 Verosh. Berosh. There's a head Berosh. In there, is there? There's a head. I get to say another kind of, head.
Yes and no. It's not a Hebrew word, so it doesn't mean head.
Oh, fine, all right.
But by the way, regarding the issue of the Hebrew lessons, I've received emails from people. If any of you people who send me emails, I have not responded to them yet because I've been very, very sick. And it's actually pretty difficult to the computer that often at the moment because I'm just in bed most of the time.
That's true. It's been snowing. I made him get out of bed to come to the program. It's been snowing and he's had a flu and he's still got a bit of a cold. But you're getting better. You'll be over it soon. But
hopefully this week, by Purim, I'm going to answer all the emails that I receive.
Are you going to get some more snow, by the way? Is it forecast?
No, probably no more snow.
Okay. Well, I hope you have a good one, my friend. Thank you again for your time. And dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Have a great Purim.
To everyone.
Shalom.